Families Against Terrorism in Jamaica, and Dr. Basil Wilson, who is the Dean of Graduate Studies in Criminal Justice at Monroe College. Thank you both very much for taking time, and hopefully we can continue this discussion. I don't know how soon, but I'd be very much interested in speaking to you further as things develop. Next, we also want to just say thanks to Inspector Steve Brown, who wanted to join us, but the last minute was not able to. Again, we want to thank him for his interest, to the Minister of Education, Mr. Holness, for taking time. And of course, Jabi, thank you both again, Yvonne McCullough Sobers and Dr. Wilson. And we'll catch up with you soon. Good. And thank you. Great. Bye-bye. And stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. You've been listening to Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest. Thank you very much, Ian. Thank you very, very much. With assistance from Seduzo Kaim Billy, and is a De Jazz Mac production. Now remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them. Show affection and with time you'll find unity and strength with love. So take care and stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. We just didn't get it straight this morning. What can I say? Walk good, one love.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, it's what you would call a quick fix morning. We're going to be playing a tape, Maxwelling and the Crick Don't Rise, a classic interview from 1976 with, oh, stay tuned.
You know, Mr. Blake, I'm going to like you an awful lot, because you're my weakness now. In this age of machinery, you walk in a beanery, you drop a nickel in the slot and get a bowl of pepper pot. That's how you dine today. There's the airplane and radio and the talking picture show. Everything's electrified. Mechanically we fly and ride. We'll soon make love that way. I want a mechanical man, a super dynamical man. Say if he picks on me and he gives me abuse, if he doesn't stop, I'll just turn off the news. Why, pressing a button on two. He'll do what I want him to do. Say if he doesn't love me in a great big way, I'll have his battery charged and Lily will be okay. I think it's a marvelous plan, don't you, to have a mechanical man. I want a mechanical man, 800 type of a man. Each evening at 10, I'll turn down the lights, I'll switch on the dial, and he'll kiss me goodnight. I'll teach him to cook and to sweep, and I'll get him to tuck me to sleep. If he gets run down and can't give me a thrill, I'll go and trade him right in for someone else who will. I'll trade him right in for a man who can, a brand new mechanical man. Oh, you little rascal. Come on, Dollar, let's go.
My weakness now. my weakness now. Oh, my. Oh, me. Oh, I should be good. I would be good, but gee. He likes to fill and poo. I never cared to fill and poo, but he likes to fill and poo. So that's my weakness now. He likes a saxophone. I never cared for a saxophone, but he likes a saxophone. So that's my weakness now. He likes those rainy days, and I never cared for a rainy day, but he likes a rainy day. So that's my weakness now. Oh, let it rain, let it fall. 'Cause I think he knows just what it's raining for. He likes a long good night, and I never had a long good night, but he likes a long good night. So that's my weakness now. And he likes futsal, and I never can futsal, but he likes futsal. So that's my weakness now. And he likes button da 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 da. No, I never can button da 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 da. But he likes button da da. So that's my weakness now. What more? What more? Oh, I think he knows what button da is for. He likes button da da. I never can spot a futu-tutu, but he likes a futu-tutu. So that's my weakness now. So that's my weakness now.
Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. She is sorry to be delayed, but last evening down in Lover's Lane she strayed. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. When she woke up and found that her dream of love was gone, madam, she ran to the man who had led her so far astray. And from under her velvet gown, she drew a gun and shot her lover down. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. When the mob came and got her and dragged her from the jail, madam, they strung her upon the old willow across the way. And the moment before she died, she lifted up her lovely head and cried. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. And the moment before she died, she lifted up her lovely head and cried. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today.
Nah, don't turn the fan off, Max. Oh, actually, now it's a more quiet room. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. Okay, there's my biggest fan. Well, that's a stupid joke, but that's never really stopped me before. The room here at WBAI is, we may be on the air, but the room is airless. The air in here is fairly fetid. Fetid. So do we think that my mystery guest is...
I think he's as ready as he will ever be.
Yes, I guess so.
Whether he can make it to the finish line is something we'll see as we go along.
Yeah, no, what pot would he be on here, and which button would make him start talking?
Oh, I would think it might be this one.
Ah, that would actually make sense. Should we try it?
Yeah, we could.
See if...
there may even be a remote start over there, except I don't know what machine this actually is.
I can press them all.
Well, see if we got anything on remote start.
Okay. Now I've pressed them all.
All right. Well, should I just start it then?
Yeah, start it. Let me put on headphones. Give it a try.
I'm sitting...
There we are. Stop. Don't let anybody... I've made it a secret who my guest is. It's cool. Okay, so it sounds like, although I sounded much deeper voiced than I would have been in 1976.
Well, maybe the speed needs to be adjusted as it goes along.
Yeah, maybe so. And we're going to be playing a recording from 1976. It's on a 10.5-inch reel. It doesn't have sticky backing, as it were. But it's got sticky fronting, which means that the physical quality of the tape isn't very good. So how would I digitize this as we play it, Max?
Well, I don't know if the new machine over there records. They, of course, made sure that you couldn't record on the playback.
Yes, exactly. We have two computers in this room that are attached to the air, and probably neither of them will master a recording.
Yes, I don't think there are inputs on
that. Ah, you know. So isn't it good to know that I'm not at the moment pitching? I'm instead, with a B. Okay.
CPU 2, but that's output.
Yeah, so let's see. Oh, well, so I actually...
you could record it onto a CD in one of the CD recorders.
Yeah, I could do that.
That's what you could do. Shall I get some?
Well, I would appreciate that. So before I intro this classic tape, which I may have to stop once or twice during the playing of it just because the gunk on it may help foul up the recorder. So we would have to clean the heads during the playing of this. And what Max Schmid and I, Jim Freund, are doing at the moment is as we play it, we're going to try to digitize this. And I've got to tell you folk, this is a nice one, but you know what? I have literally hundreds and hundreds, perhaps even thousands of hours of tape on cassettes. Yeah, if I include the cassettes, it's without question thousands of hours of air checks from Hour of the Wolf and other things. This is not strictly speaking an Hour of the Wolf. This was when a book came out and the author came in. He was on a big publicity tour. And so we just recorded it about three-quarters of the way through. I am joined, in fact, by Margot Adler, which is way cool. So we end up doing the interview together, although I'm a very smart producer, which is to say I knew to shut up and let her talk. So Max chuckles knowingly.
So it's recording, and it's ready to roll.
Oh, very good, very good. I'll just start it when I roll the tape, because
okay,
there's...
Well,
it's recording now.
You can hit pause.
Oh, okay. Well, you might as well just let it roll. And, can I switch one halfway through? Do we have two working?
This one should be working as well.
No, let's pause it.
What was the total length? I didn't notice.
Of this, it should be about an hour. Is it written
it was
on
more
the?
More than an hour, but it's probably less than the 80-minute capacity of your disc.
Yeah, where's the? What did we do with the box? Here it is. I would think I would have put the time, well, the original label, of course, fell off a long time ago. Yeah, so I don't have it on here. But I think it's not more than 70 minutes.
Okay.
And how long will the CD record for?
80 minutes.
Oh, fine. No, a single reel-to-reel tape won't be 80 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. So, let's roll it.
Oh, I'm not putting it on yet.
Oh, okay. Let's not roll it.
I have other things to do on the air. I have announcements to make. Promises to keep. Well, an announcement. This Tuesday, not the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And this is something, Max, I think you would enjoy if you were able. Have you ever heard of a movie called Kinzaza?
Don't believe so.
No, I guess not. Some people, and I think this is an exaggeration, call it one of the best science fiction films ever made.
Must be Russian.
How did you know? Yes, it is Russian, as a matter of fact. And it's a comedy. Which that rare thing, a Russian comedy, and it comes from the Glasnost era. It is either 1985 or 1986, and it is very Sheckley-esque. I think that it probably takes a cue or two from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which, of course, took a cue or two in the original 1977 radio drama from Bob Sheckley in a few ways. Ways that I thought bordered on plagiarism, and something I discussed with Douglas Adams when he was on this show first in 1978, not long after the recording that we're about to hear was. But at any rate, I came across this movie first about 3 years ago. It's now out on DVD, but at the time, it was not at all. How to describe it? A corporate type, an architect, and an artist type, a musician, are on a street corner. A fellow shows up and hysterically demands matches. He needs matches in order to be able to do, and he's crazy. It's obvious that he's crazy. And he says, if you strike this match, be very careful. Don't strike that match. It will take you to another galaxy. Yeah, right. And so one lights a cigarette for the other, and they're in another galaxy. The galaxy of Kinzaza. And they end up on a planet, a desert planet, where the vocabulary consists of one word. And that word is koo. They have many forms of variations on koo. If you bend this knee that way, it means one thing. You bend that one another way, it means another thing. It's a very political comedy, which is a lot of fun for 1986 Glasnost Soviet Union. And it has become a cult favorite among expatriates and satellite countries from the former Soviet bloc, and never properly released in the West. This DVD is out, and it is totally obscure, and I recommend it on two levels, three levels, actually. One, it's funny. Two, it's good science fiction. And there's a lot of decent to brilliant Soviet science fiction. At least one person said this is the best Russian science fiction film ever made, which is ridiculous on the face of it, because there's Solaris and there's The Sacrifice and Stalker. Well, each of those three are directed by Andrei Tarkovsky. So any Tarkovsky film that by a stretch of the imagination, which is what it takes, a stretch of the imagination, could be referred to as science fiction or fantasy, is better. But this movie wasn't, striving to be a deep, provocative film, although it has a little bit of that, and that's the third level, the political and social level of looking into the mind and society of Glasnost Soviet Union. So, this is not, I mean, like the New York Review of Science Fiction readings that we hold in the same location where this will be. This is not a free event. By way of full disclosure, this is an event that costs less, actually, than your average. I was going to say the same as an average movie, but it's actually less because movies are so darned expensive. And this being a non-profit, non-commercial radio station, we're not going to tell you the price. I will tell you that it doesn't go into double digits, okay? It's, you know, it's under $10. And you will have fun. It is really an enjoyable movie. We're not showing this in a plan to make loads of money. We are showing this because it'll be neat, and I think you will all enjoy it. This is the beginning of a film series that I am doing with John Ordover, who is the proprietor. You know, yes, once upon a time he was the editor of all the Star Trek books at Pocket Books, but now he's the proprietor of this digital art gallery, which, by the way, has a very, very cool exhibit going on right now, Other Worlds, which was curated by Keith DeCandido, of artwork from science fiction books of many kinds. And if you ever come to a Nyarsif reading, the ones that I produce there, and those are free, you can see the fabulous imagery, the ability to show different things on the screens around the room. This will be a big video screen, by the way. And no, I'm sorry, no, that's misleading. It's a video projector going onto a large screen, you know, the kind that you used to have in school. That, you know, it's a gallery. It's not a big place. It seats comfortably about 30 and uncomfortably about 50. I don't think we're going to get anywhere near that many people, but I'm trying to get a few of you there, and that's why I'm mentioning this on the radio. Apparently, we're, according to Ordover, we're reaching out also to the Russian community. So we'll probably see a good portion of Brooklyn there. That would be cool. It's actually near where I live nowadays. So the name of the movie, if you want to look it up and get more information, again, is Kindzadza, K-I-N-D-Z-A-D-Z-A. In fact, there is a trailer for this on YouTube, and you can... I tweeted, if you have access to Twitter, and you don't actually have to be a member of Twitter, you can just go to twitter.com/JimFreund, J-I-M-F-R-E-U-N-D, no spaces in there, and take a look at the various tweets that I sent out on Friday. And I sent out about 4 or 5, which is a lot for me. One of them has a link to the trailer for the movie. And I'll tell you where it is. You know, I'll tell you where it is later, at the end of the show. I'm not going to pull it all up on the computer and fiddle faddle the way I usually do. Okay. So I'm not even sure which episode is on BBC America tonight of Doctor Who. I think it's probably Amy's Choice. And the last three have been pretty darn good. Overall, this season has surprised me with its quality, because I really thought that it wasn't going to work out. But I have to say, especially with the last couple that I have seen, and I'm about 2 weeks ahead of BBC America, the ones that I have seen very, very much resemble the original Doctor Who, with all of its old plot lines and melodrama and comedy. So that's on BBC America tonight at, I think it's 9 o'clock. Oh, they play it a whole lot. So do check that out. Okay. In 1976, and this show, of course, has been on the air since 1972, first with Margot Adler, who created the show, and then she left in about 1974. In talking with Margot recently, I have been amazed to realize that she didn't know all of these years by heart, and she thought that maybe she had left the show in 75 or something like that. No, because it was when she went to Clarion. She went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop in the summer of 1974, and that's very documentable because that was one of the first Clarion Wests, and she remembers who her teachers were: Harlan Ellison, Samuel R. Delaney, Joanna Russ, Ursula K. Le Guin, you know, amazing people. So we were able to document when it was. So anyway, Margot started the show, and you will be hearing her in this tape. Although this comes from several years later, and I had called her and said, "Quick, I will have Frank Herbert here." And sure enough, she did show up for that. And Frank was doing a tour for the book Children of Dune. This is actually the second of three times that I interviewed him. The others were rather brief. And I don't know where those interviews are. I mentioned I have, you know, thousands of hours of tapes. It's among them. And a lot of those are just, you know, unlabeled. But I am hoping at some point to find a way. First, I need I'm setting up the equipment, then I need the time and perhaps the intern or something, or the grant, to be able to digitize all this stuff. And I'll make it available freely. I'm not looking to make any bucks on this whatsoever. But I am looking to preserve this stuff and make it a legacy. Okay? So we'll deal with that. Oh, by the way, going back to the event, Ken Zadza, let me remind you, it's this coming Tuesday, June 8th. It starts at 7 o'clock. You show up at 6:30. It's on Sullivan Street between Prince and Houston. And I'll give you the exact address. I think it's 138 Sullivan Street. It's the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. But I'll give you the phone number and all the information at the end of the show. But I just realized I had forgotten to stress when the event was, so you can circle it on your calendar and say, oh, yes, I definitely want to see Ken Zadza. Okay, so going back, hopping back and forth between time, this was my second and most worthy interview with Frank Herbert. I wouldn't say that I was especially deep, but he was always especially interesting and very political. And we talked, of course, with the release of Children of Dune, which was a very good book. I mean, I of course, like everybody, I really enjoyed Dune. I don't think it's one of the greatest books ever written, but I really, really enjoyed it, and I read it dozens of times like everybody else. I thought Dune Messiah sucked. I thought it was awful, okay? Plain and simple, it was awful. But Children of Dune fixed that. Children of Dune was very well done, a worthy successor, and it should have been a trilogy, in my humble opinion. Should have all ended there. And of course, the books are still being written by Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert, and I haven't read them, I have to admit. But there are so many spin-offs at this point. It's an industry. Dune is an industry. And really, it was Children of Dune that in one way was sort of the closing, but in another way was the beginning of that industry. It was the thing that sealed the ability to make Dune a franchise. And Frank was on a major publicity tour. He hardly even remembered that we had done an interview before, because he was, this is one of the reasons that I tend not to work with writers when they are on publicity tours, but rather make contact with them directly and work some things out so that it's calmer. This is a 5 a.m. show, you know. I'm not looking for that hard-hitting kind of thing. Rather, I want people to be comfortable, intellectual, etc. Okay? So, with all of that buildup, you set your Wayback Machine for 1976. I don't remember the date or the month. And the only reason that I knew that it was, you know, mid-70s, and the only reason that I know the year is because I looked up when Children of Dune was published, and it was 1976, and that fits in perfectly with my memory. So there are a couple of blanks. You're pretty much hearing raw tape. It's unedited. It's not spruced up or anything like that, which is generally the way I like to broadcast my interviews, with blemishes and all, just like this program. And there will be a point, as I said, near the end of the interview, for the last 15 minutes, that Margot Adler joins us. So, as I said, set your Wayback Machine for 1976. There may be interruptions, as we may need to clean the machine. Oh yeah, let me start that air check. Digital air check that Max so thoughtfully set up for me. So again, set your Wayback Machine for 1976 and listen in with first myself, Jim Freund, and Frank Herbert over WBAI in New York City, and then we are joined by Margot Adler.
I'm sitting in WBAI Studio A talking with a person who I really wanted to meet for a long time by the name of Frank Herbert, who is author of Dune, Dune Messiah, The Children of Dune. No, not The Children of Dune, Children of Dune. Santaroga Barrier, Destination Void, Dragon in the Sea, which goes under about 20 other names. What else? What books would you...
You
advice.
Want a complete list, right?
Yeah. What books would you like people to read?
Well, you're going to science fiction. How about Eyes of Heisenberg?
Heisenberg, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I read that as Heisenberg's Eyes, I think.
That's okay.
I'm just trying to remember. That.
How about Hellstrom's Hive?
Hellstrom's Hive. Mm-hmm. Soul Catcher?
Yeah.
How would you classify that?
Soul Catcher? It's a novel.
Okay. Do you disdain the term science fiction?
Nope, not at all. I don't take part in the argument about mainstream, new wave,
old wave. I don't take a part in any of these arguments. I think they're nonsense arguments. A lot of people argue about mainstream and science fiction. I think what you do is you write the best you're able, no matter which category you choose. And the difference between them is the difference between jazz and classical.
Max just pointed out, if I had interviewed him before, why was I happy to meet him? So this must have been the first interview.
Use the same notes, the same notation, and many of the same instruments. Which do you prefer? What a nonsense question. Sometimes I like classical, sometimes I like jazz. It depends on the mood I'm in at the time.
When you are in one of these moods, do you set out to write a particular kind of novel?
Oh, I always plot very strongly, very heavily, and in depth. I always do deep characterization. I have file folders with each character's name on it and the data in it. I may bring a character on stage at age 30 on page 40 of a novel, but I'll have a file folder wherein I've taken that person's history back to year one and earlier. I know who his parents were, when he was born, what trauma he suffered growing up, where he went to school, his first sexual experience, everything.
I would like to see the file of Pander Olsen.
Pander Olsen? Well, you know who Pander Olsen is, don't you?
Well, it's an obvious anagram to people who are familiar with science fiction.
Yes, Paul Anderson.
Right.
Well, we play this as a kind of a game, you see. I have another character in there who in one of my books called Hol Jans Van Brugge, who is a very famous science fiction writer. You don't know. John Holbrook Vance. Who is not Henry Kuttner, who is...
not Bruce J. Friedman.
Were you aware that Bruce J. Friedman wrote some softcore pornography under the name Jack Vance?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, just to confuse matters.
Yeah. Well, Jack is a very real person, a great writer, and one of my closest friends.
Really?
Yes, but we play these games with each other every now and then. In fact, Paul and Jack and I plotted a story one time while we were building a houseboat down in the San Francisco Bay Area. We were going to write the story together. It didn't work out that we would, but we...
But we did get a nice name for the author, who would be the three of us, and that was Noah Arkwright.
I like that.
Well, let me ask you something about the file of Pander Olsen, because he appears, I've noticed, in at least two different things. He is a biographer of St. Dahlia of the Knife.
Mm-hmm.
He is also a lawyer who who attempted to defend the tactful saboteur.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bear with me. Obviously, this machine is having issues playing back this tape. It is squealing. If I had the mic on in here while this was playing, it would sound like a banshee. And there's no remote start, so I have to go, about 10 feet away. Bear with me while I cue this up.
Who attempted to defend the tactful...
Now, you hear that? My voice was never that deep. Okay, so... Let us, try this.
The Saboteur,
mm-hmm.
in the story of the same name. Mm-hmm. McCree, I think his name was.
McKay,
and yeah. Watt.
Mm-hmm. George X. McKay.
Well, we're going to try George this X. for a while.
What does the X stand for? I'm curious.
Javier.
Has Mr. Olsen done any other things already?
Well, you must realize that because Pander Olsen began as a kind of an in-gag between Paul and Jack and I, that he serves only one function. He is an archivist. He is somebody we refer to when we want some little erudite datum to come in or some special ability which nobody else has, you see, such as an expert on a particular area of law.
Mm-hmm.
it's a joke we have with each other. We're all very good friends.
I was wondering if you might take one of those files originally intended for one particular stage, as you put it, mm-hmm. and put that person on stage somewhere else.
No, not really. I'll keep a character for a particular kind of story where the same name and the same persona apply.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't bring that character into another story without some changes that fit the other story. You see, when I write, I don't write the way a lot of other writers tell me they write. It's more like composing.
Because I plot heavily, I plot in depth, and I'm carrying quite a number of threads through any given book,
mm-hmm.
several levels. You might have an adventure story, it might have a psychological suspense line through it, that sort of thing, you see. And I'm very conscious of the rhythms that are necessary for any given moment in a story. Do I need short sentences and a lot of action verbs here to pound the action along? Do I need passive voice here? Do I need reflexive moments with long, involved, and convoluted sentences? It depends, you see. The demands of the moment in the story, the demands of the story, kind of negotiate this.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to backtrack a little. I was looking over various aspects of different biographies. I've seen a few, none of which conflict, fortunately, but which show a gigantic diversity. And I was wondering if you might, in 5 minutes or so, tell us the story of your life.
Well, first place, every writer I know...
Isn't that a ridiculous question, by the way?
Yes, that is a ridiculous question.
But I mean,
why don't you go stand in the corner while I answer it?
Large room.
Every writer I know who thinks of himself as a professional writer has a mind like a sponge. And I not only have that, I have a mind full of odd, small items of data. But I also like to go and see for myself.
Mm-hmm.
When there were lots of questions about Vietnam, I went there as a war correspondent.
For which paper?
For the Hearst Headline Service.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a documentary movie there.
I wasn't aware.
With my wife. I won't pull that joke again, I promise.
You can guess.
No, I may as well do it. We have an in-joke in the family that we have the only two draft-age boys in the United States who sent their mother to Vietnam. my own feeling is that if you're going to write about it, do it. If you're going to write about flying, fly. I'm a pilot. If you're going to write about diving, dive. And so I have a lot of things I've done. But essentially, I'm a writer. The diversity is picking up grist for the mill.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see? And so the diversity you read in the in these sketchy biographies in the books, they were interesting at the time, the things I've done. And sometimes I did them to support myself and my family. Sometimes I did them because I just wanted to. Does that answer your question? I mean, I'm not going to go in enormous detail. You can find that elsewhere.
What professions have you had that you've not yet incorporated into books that you think you might like to?
Oh, I think you use everything. You don't hold back anything. If a moment comes when you need knowledge about pressure datum planes in under the sea, you use it. Do you follow what I'm saying? You pick up what you have. You don't have little congeries of information in your head, not if you're a whole person. You may, for the purposes of writing a book, build up a fragmented personality of yourself. Each little congeree in your head is another character, and so for the duration of the book, you're a fragmented person.
Mm-hmm.
Little schizoid because you're playing 9 or 10 roles, but when the book's over, you come back to Earth.
How did you research, and this is plunging right headlong into deep aspects of your writing, how did you research how one would live in, say, Siege Tabor?
I lived in the desert.
And please correct my pronunciation.
Siege Tabor, yes.
Siege Tabor.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first place, CH is a word that originated in the Caucasus,
mm-hmm.
where there was a real language called Chukobsa, which was a hunting language used by the Muslims of the Caucasus.
Mm-hmm.
And they were people with a cave personality because they lived in cave enclaves, so I studied about them. I lived in the desert. I went to every source I could find about cave personalities or congested living, because it's not just necessarily a cave warren that you have. It's a warren, you see. It's where people live very close together. And it's very likely that the city, as we know it as a place where many people are very close together, was invented in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. That is, it originated there. And so I did a great deal of study of the Middle East and the way people adjusted to living very close together, and large numbers of people very close together. I also wrote a for the purposes of being ecologically explicit in the Dune trilogy, I wrote a or created a an ecological language and a script for it. Mm. The script was a pictograph script, and I contend that most of the scripts we use in the world today began as pictographs. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted that in my psyche when I did it. All of these things went into it. I've done the things, some of the things. I haven't lived in a cave, but you don't really need to live in a cave to get that feeling once you've immersed yourself in all the data.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the roots of the words in the language of Arrakis?
Most of the roots are Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a multiple reason for that. I used an Elysian process to change some of them. Languages change. Mm-hmm. English is a very fluid form of communication, which is changing yearly, daily, sometimes hourly. Radio and television are influencing this. And I did a great deal of research into comparative religions. And so, of course, I could not overlook Muslim and its Arabic roots. And so I used Arabic. One of the major reasons is that for our culture, if you're going to say desert, you think Arab.
Mm-hmm.
You see. And they have a marvelous culture. They were ecologically sane long before any other culture ever even thought of it. They had spoken and unspoken rules. For example, they would not build habitations on arable land.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are other words like, and I know I am going to lose of the pronunciation.
Don't worry about pronunciation. Kwisatz Haderach.
Thank you.
The Kwisatz Haderach comes right out of Jewish mythology.
Mm-hmm.
The Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
And again, another religion.
Now, there's the mysticism,
yeah. You see. And the Kwisatz Haderach in the Kabbalah, or Kabbalah as it's pronounced, is a person who can be many places at once, who has this capability.
Mm-hmm.
So I took it right out of the Jewish mythology.
And put it in the mother religion of...
Well, you see, the mother religion here is an amalgam, as most religions that we have now are.
Mm-hmm.
We've just lost some of their roots. Christianity, for example, doesn't admit to its roots in Mithraism, but they're there for anybody who wants to look for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What religions mostly go into the B'nai Gesserit?
Well,
and that I must have mispronounced.
I used Bene Gesserit because I was thinking of female Jesuits.
Aha. Uh-huh.
They were kind of my model. well, of course, Christianity. Sunni, the Muslim mystics. Sufism. Zen. Buddhism out of Gautama. Not, in other words, prior to Zen. Islam, of course. Islam is a very strong element of the whole trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
We tend in this culture not to study Islam and not to recognize how much it has contributed to our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the religious wars out of which our present consciousness has come, the awareness. But we owe Islam enormous debts of gratitude.
Would I be right in detecting a smidgen of pagan witchcraft of more or less the Gardnerian tradition?
Oh, the golden bough is there, of course, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a very good way of putting it.
The mother goddesses and so on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because the person for whom I'm substituting, Margot Adler, is very involved in study and pursuit of Gardnerian witchcraft. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling people listening would be, as I am also, really interested in what goes into the religion Bene Gesserit. And, I mean, if it were here, I certainly couldn't join, but I could certainly follow it mentally.
Well, you know that I'm contending, in, not just in this book, but in several books, that that we can implant a religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's noted that the Bene Gesserit would be constantly putting slogans of thought, slogans of ideas.
They would be sinking concepts into the unconscious of a population.
Before something would
to
happen.
To prepare for any problem that might arise.
Mm-hmm. Is this being done?
Do I think that this is being done in our world?
Yes, I do.
Oh, I do too. I think that certain power enclaves in our society do this consciously with protective forethought.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that it's fully protective, or in some cases?
Well, I think they believe it protects them, but I believe it's like a double-edged sword without a handle. If you grasp it hard enough to use it, you're going to injure yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be the first victim.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is, yet that doesn't, the Bene Gesserit, however, are far more wise. At least, I have a feeling they may not be, because I'm only to a certain degree into Children of Dune. It appears that something may have backfired.
Well, remember this, that as far as the whole trilogy is concerned, I was taking an unexamined assumption of our society, mm-hmm, and holding it up to another kind of examination. And that assumption is that if a hero is good for us, the superhero must be better,
yeah,
for us. And my contention is that every superhero that Western society has had has left the society poorer. Mm-hmm. And that many of the characteristics of the superheroes tend not to surface. They tend to be suppressed. It's unusual when the things that might draw down opprobrium about a superhero surface later. Look at Hitler, though. He lost a war, you see. If he had won, he would have been a superhero. He destroyed his society. Look at Kennedy. Kennedy was one of the worst things that ever happened to this society, because people followed him without question.
Mm-hmm.
They did not question what he was doing. The nature of the superhero in Western culture just has not been examined, and what they do to a culture. And so I was examining that in this trilogy. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, because the hero doesn't come out like the heroes usually do in Hollywood stories, where they walk off into the sunset arm in arm.
Well, I've discovered that immensely. I recently read The Santa Rosa Barrier,
mm-hmm,
and the end of that book, I tried to pick up another book. I couldn't. That had me shivering.
Well, let me tell you about the Santa Rosa Barrier. I wrote it very carefully to be a wedge in the stream, so that the people who read it would, about half of them would think I was talking about a utopia,
mm-hmm,
and about half would think I was talking about a dystopia. I balanced it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And here is another thing that's not very often examined in our society. We tend to, in this society, think that the only thing keeping us from utopia is another law, or we haven't invented the right machine yet.
Mm-hmm.
And this is utter nonsense. Great societies are great because of the character of the people they develop, not because of the laws they have.
Mm-hmm.
A society with too much law is going to be a poorer society.
What about a society with no law?
Well, it depends on what their basis for motivation is, whether they are motivated with out of respect for each other. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, maybe there is a law, you see.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how you look at what we perceive of as law. How do you perceive law? Our society tends to look at law as a cure-all. And it isn't. It's a dead-end street.
How did previous societies, in that case, how did law originate?
Well, I think
that's a better question.
I think law originated as a religious inhibition, and it had organizational motivation. What were the necessities of the society in which the law originated?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have to note that for societies that where religion was the law, to break the law was to sin.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a very strong unconscious damper on everything that the people do. We tend toward that in our society. We tend to make the law religious in its intonations, and to our detriment.
Yet I note that there is a sort of law of the freemen that fits in to their...
It helps their survival in their surroundings.
Very much so.
Yes.
And the desert mouse comes along.
But where their society changes, where their surroundings change, then the laws have to change. They have to adapt. And if the laws are rigid, and especially if the laws are seated in religion or are looked on theologically as they are in our society,
mm-hmm.
we build a theological aura around law in our society. where that happens, then the law tends not to change, to adapt to new conditions, and it injures the society severely.
Well, for those that did not follow Muad'Dib, and there were many,
mm-hmm.
Were they sinners?
Well, in the eyes of the jihad, of course they were sinners, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, now, the jihad succeeds.
Of course.
And... Princess Erlan is sitting there moping, and the only other word I can think of is not arable. But in a sense, cuckolded, more or less, by her husband. It is a marriage of convenience that
mm-hmm.
she wants to be a real marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yet she is supporting that religion. She is building that up and...
Think of her conditioning.
Okay.
She was conditioned by the Bene Gesserits and by... an imperial family. She had her duty.
But that duty to the Shaddam reign, mm-hmm. Did that just disappear?
No, it was transmitted legally to Paul, you see.
Mm. And their and legal mm-hmm. part is
that
all
was
that
the
really
law
mattered.
And the duty now, you see.
That seems to be more, in that case, of law turning into religion. As
that's exactly what I was dealing with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of seems to be a reverse of what has happened here.
Mm-hmm.
I find that totally fascinating.
Although, you see, it's cyclic. We originated, our law originated in religion, came out of religion into a conscious attempt to manipulate society,
mm-hmm.
and then went back into its theological cocoon. Where it is now in our society.
Mm-hmm. And to where will it go?
Where will it go? I think it's cyclic. I think it'll come out again.
You think it will?
Oh, yes.
Where would you like to see it go?
Well, I would like to see us become more pragmatic in our dealings with deep motivations, deep psychological motivations in society. I don't favor, for example, a gratuitous increase in drug use in the society, but I do think that that we don't deal with drugs with any kind of sensitivity, with any sensibility, with any rational response.
Mm-hmm.
Our society is composed of people who seem to need a mind changing. We've lived with alcohol for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol is a drug. And it is probably one of the most dangerous drugs that we have in the world today. It causes a lot of deaths. It's very addictive. it creates enormous problems in our own society. It's creating enormous problems in the Russian society right now. We found that prohibition doesn't work. What prohibition did in our society was give organized crime the capital base so that they could shift to other drugs when we legalized alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Now we, you see, trying to prohibit these things does two things. It throws them into a criminal control, and it increases the number of people who use them, people seeking the thrill.
What was the thrill of the original people who discovered Jaspers in Santa Rosa?
In Santa Rosa Barrier?
Mm-hmm.
It was the thrill of a common, of a unified social action, very much linked to something like a Jungian collective unconscious.
Mm.
Do you see?
Yes, I think I do. What proposals would you take to decrease drug usage, dangerous drug
usage?
Well,
we know where most of the new users come from. They come from present users building a market to support their own habits.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really simple way to reduce drug use in the society. You take the criminal profit out of it.
Mm-hmm.
England found this. The United States ought to look at that very carefully and get off its Puritan high horse and solve the problem for the society. We would have fewer addicts if we would legalize to a degree, legalize drug use, and for those who are actually addicted, make their fix available to them for 50 cents at the corner drugstore. We'd have far, far fewer users than we have now.
And what would you think?
This would not solve the problem as people conceive of the problem, you see. It would just reduce the arena in which it operates. The problem in New York is not drug abuse. It is the cost of the drugs and the ancillary crime to support that cost.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's the problem. And the answer is obvious. You take the profit out of it. You reduce the cost.
Okay, at this point, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
A production company in Paris, France, bought the rights to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Camera One. The producer is Michel Seydoux. The director is Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Mm-hmm.
Jodorowsky, I talked to on the telephone the other day, and apparently the production, having spent more than $2 million on a $9 million budget, has been put on the back burner for about 8 months while they look up a new distribution contract, while they try to tie down distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know enough about the movie industry to know if that's sensible, but that's what I've been told. I have seen the script, by the way.
You didn't write it.
I did not write the script. Translating a book into film is really a translating process. You translate it from one language to another.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not absolutely sure that the author can do the best job.
Of translation.
Of translating, that's right.
But
you need somebody who speaks that language intimately.
Well, I'm one of those people that takes a look at a book that I really enjoy, such as Dune. And somebody, I think it was first 2 years ago, mentioned to me, they're going to be making a movie of Dune. My first impulse was, oh no.
Well, Jodorowsky has produced a script which follows the book carefully.
Does it follow the characters?
It follows the characters. The character development, I'm not sure because I have not seen film. And character development is a process that happens on the screen, not in the script.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another difference in between film and the written word. But the script itself follows the book. The character indications follow the book.
Mm-hmm.
The visuals are magnificent.
Where are they filming?
The last thing I saw was that they were going to do the principal photography, that is, with the actors, in Algeria. Mm. Now, with this hiatus, I do not know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
They have 2 years, by the way, in their contract to produce a film.
Mm-hmm.
Two more years.
2 more years?
Yes.
So there is yet a good deal of time.
Yes.
Now, is the script, would you call it linear as opposed to what Jodorowsky had with El Topo?
Linear? Well, it's linear to the degree that the book is.
It is?
Yes.
That was one of the more important questions to me, mm-hmm. because he's an absolutely fascinating director, using different techniques. And
his visual imagination is superb.
Yeah.
He has the eye of a camera genius, and with a genius, anything can happen. You can have just a magnificent film or a sensational flop,
mm-hmm.
but you're not going to have anything in between.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you thought of your other books in terms of movies? I think that Santa Rosa Barrier would be a magnificent film.
We're going to be negotiating a contract on Santa Rosa Barrier tomorrow.
You are?
Mm-hmm.
That's good news. Who would be directing that?
Well, I'm not at liberty to say anything at all about it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll just say this. Recently, comparing the movie version of the book, The Man Who Fell to Earth, mm-hmm. by Walter Tevis, or Tevis, I'm not
Tevis.
Sure. Tevis. To the film, I thought that was a very well-done adaptation. With Santa Rosa Barrier, you have a movie that requires next to no special effects.
No.
Could be done on a normal budget. In fact, almost below budget when you consider normal nowadays means...
Well, as they say in Hollywood, you could bring it in for a mill.
Yeah. Okay. But there, the scripting is really going to require a great deal. And I'm not so sure that it's going to be a question of just transferring to the screen.
Well, remember this, that the screen, that the film does not get into the mind of the character easily.
Mm-hmm. Who we're seeing through the window is the woman whose program I'm substituting for, Marco Adler, who I think is going to come in.
You know what I mean by that? That you
mm-hmm. okay?
Margot, she's tiptoeing.
Do you want to take a seat and join in on this? It's your show.
Are you sure?
Okay, we'll edit that out.
Anyway,
so.
Just as character development happens on the screen, so does what's going on unconsciously. Mm-hmm. Have to happen on the screen. It has to be visual. And you can't have people stand up as they used to do in Shakespeare's day and march to the edge of the podium and say, what he's really thinking is, and then tell you what he's really thinking.
Well, the visuals of the mind's eye are still, to me, the most impressive. John Brunner termed it as, they build the nicest sets.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there I would say that it would be the original writer.
Well, it's the difference
in the case
between,
of Santa Rosa,
it's the difference between radio and television. With radio, the reader's or the listener's imagination must be enlisted to its fullest.
Yes, which is why I love
radio. I use an example of out of pre-TV radio
mm-hmm.
of a joke on Allen's Alley. Where his character comes back from India, and Alan says, "Did you get any new jokes?" Or no, excuse me, I'm misleading you. He said, "Did you learn any new tricks in India?"
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, "Oh yes. Here I'll show you. First I lift my left foot. Now I lift my right foot." And then there followed the longest dead air. I was tempted here to just to replay it.
Mm-hmm.
You see, just time goes by and nothing happens. You wonder if the studio has caught fire or the tower has been toppled or something. And then, very distant, in an echo box, Jerry Colonna says, "Well, don't just stand there. Somebody get me down." Now, your mind will go along with the gag, and you'll see him drifting off in the corner of nowhere. You see, far more dramatically than if you had done it visually. If you did it for television, it'd fall on its face. You'd say, "Where are the wires?"
Absolutely. But this is an example of what I mean. In a book that is, and people can't see me wiggling my fingers to say in quotes, down to earth as the Santa Rosa Barrier.
As so relevant.
Well, I still see the original dialogue, the original action from the book being there as it is in the book without somebody meddling and say, "Well, needs more sex." Or
I certainly hope so.
Show a little blood when that truck falls.
Yeah.
That is a case in which I would really only like to trust the original author.
Or trust the discretion of the translator. And there are some good movie translators around, you know.
Yes, but they're limited. You see, frankly, you'll find that I just don't trust producers.
Oh, but, well, I'm not talking about producers. I'm talking about directors.
Producers, okay.
Yeah. We have, I've done a script, for example, for Soulcatcher. And we may have a movie deal on that before too many weeks have passed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm satisfied with the script that's been done about Dune. I think it's well done. Very well done.
Who did Yadorovsky hire? He did it himself.
Mm-hmm. Probably with some of his creative crew help, but I'm sure that Yadorovsky dominated it.
If you were to have seen something in there that you didn't like, that you said, "No, this is not the novel that I set down on paper, set into celluloid or whatever," what could you or would you do?
What could I do? Well, I'm in the contract as technical advisor.
Oh, you are?
And I'm sure they would listen, mm-hmm. and they might even react favorably. But I'm not one of these people who would stand there tearing my hair saying, "Oh, my God, what you're doing to my baby." Because that's not the way it goes. I just couldn't emphasize too much, too strongly, that it is a translating process. It's as though you were translating into a foreign language.
Mm-hmm. What other media would you like to work?
Oh, I'm in the media I enjoy.
Well, you've worked as was it a TV news commentator?
I was a radio news commentator.
Radio news commentator. And I believe you've done some work on television.
Oh, yes. I've been I've had a little experience with television commentating for the old Don Lee network out in the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But in the creative aspect, where would you like to break into?
Where I am.
Just writing.
Yeah. It's what I do best. It's where I feel I belong. It's where I enjoy doing what I do best. Why should I do anything else?
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see other translators of other mediums come to you? And
for what?
Well, say I were to come to you, and who knows, maybe a few years from now or a few months from now I will, and say I would like to do a radio adaptation of The Tactful Saboteur.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like you to script it.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm working on a script with Samuel R. Delaney.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what I...
One of Chip's stories or what?
One of his stories. It's We Who Move on a Rigorous Line... No, we in Some Strange Powers employ move on a rigorous line. It's such an involved title that I get the different phrases of it mixed up. And essentially what I said to him was, he said to me, "Well, did you do a script?" This was 2 days ago. I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can I see it?" I said, "Nope." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "I put it aside for 2 weeks. I read it."
it's not the story that I read originally. Therefore, you have to do it. Now, here we're dealing with a different medium. We're dealing with radio and the mind's eye.
Well, radio would be closer to the book or the story than the visual media would be.
It usually is. Would you script radio? Because that is very close to...
I might be tempted to script radio, depending on the project, but I'd have to think very long and seriously about it, and I might not, you see. I might not.
How do you decide your projects?
Oh, time and interest, primarily.
Do you usually just write a manuscript and send it out to a publisher? Or
I finish a manuscript before sending it out.
The I'm publisher may not even be aware that you are working on one.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That has happened less lately.
Now, with... there's a certain point at which they turn around and start grabbing. I assume that people have already said, take the Dune trilogy and make it a tetralogy. Might that happen?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
When you wrote Dune, did you have the entire trilogy set out?
Oh, yes. Before I wrote the first book, I knew where the third one was going.
Mm-hmm. And
I had them all plotted. You see?
Fully.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see any... So you don't see any room for a fourth book or take it beyond where this ends?
No. This does what I set out to do.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to read it. The only reason I ask is because I saw in one of the clippings that Putnam sent me some comment on the order of, well, the book ends, I understand, similar to Dune in that something will happen. You know something is going to happen at the end.
Well, I take the reader into my confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I always have. I believe that that writing is a game you play between your own imagination and the reader's imagination, and you have to respect the reader's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You have to enlist it to its fullest capabilities. And you have to allow the reader's imagination to write as many variations on the theme in his head as he wants to write,
mm-hmm.
as he feels capable of writing or is interested in writing. All of these things apply. And so I write to spin the reader out of the story, but with lots of it fish-hooked into his mind, trailing in his mind, so that he can play games with it even further. And so I've done that, obviously, in Dune, and I do it again in Children of Dune. But I send them back into the beginning of the story in a cyclic fashion, you see.
Mm-hmm. Are you not afraid, though, that... 100 years from now, somebody's going to take a look at this classic book and say, needs a sequel. And some stumble bum is going to attempt it and publish it.
Let him. Why should I be worried about that? If it's any good, marvelous. If it's not any good, I doubt if it'll succeed.
Mm. Margot Adler, sitting quietly in the room, asks a question which we already touched on, but I would like to get back to because there are just so many things to explore. When we were, quote, playing that cut of music or turned off the mic for a minute, we were saying there are so many different things you can explore, so many directions to go within SF that there's just no way that... you can know exactly where you're going to be leading.
No two performances are going to be identical, as it is with jazz.
Yeah, and you can barely skim the surface. So pardon me if I go back to what was before.
You want absolution, or you just want to be temporarily forgiven?
Absolution. I couldn't bear people. Okay, well, getting back to the concept of the Bene Gesserit... are you aware? Well, why do you ask this yourself? Come over here.
I was just wondering if you are aware that there's a group that is starting or has been planning to start in the last 3 years a school of American shamanism under the name of the Bene Gesserit School.
Think of it as Bene Gesserit, as female.
It is time for me to just tell you all what you've been listening to for a while. This is a very old tape, which, thanks to the assiduous work and craft of Max Schmid, I would never have thought to put in a piece of cotton on the erase head.
Soundproofing right off the wall, Jim. You just rip off little chunks of it.
There we go. You are listening to an interview with Frank Herbert, recorded in 1976, with myself, Jim Freund, and, as you can now hear, added in Margot Adler. I'm here talking with Ken Gale, and we're having a fine old time. But I did promise you all that Margot would be on this tape. And, of course, at the point when Adler came in, of course, the first thing that we would be discussing is the Bene Gesserit. So, just needed you to know that you're listening to WBAI in New York City at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org, and that this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and you're hearing a rebroadcast of an interview with Frank Herbert, with myself and Margot Adler.
Jesuits.
Uh-huh. Oh, they won't like that. The school is definitely pagan.
Well, the Jesuits have a lot of pagan roots, you know. They wouldn't admit that, but, well, some of them would. I've met a couple of Jesuits who would.
Mm-hmm.
But the... that's fine. Let them have their games, and that's exactly what I was talking about just now. You leave those openings in what you do, because you have confidence in the imagination of your fellow humans. You don't talk down to them, you don't talk up to them, you talk straight across to them. You say, hey, this is a marvelous game to play, we will play it anyway, why don't we play it this way for a while?
What would happen, let's conceive of this, we were before discussing religion as law and law as religion. What would happen if this group becomes quite popular, increasingly so, and in fact starts a bit of a movement within the U.S. You're going to be sitting there sort of the creator of the creator, so to speak.
Well, I hope that they don't get so lost in their own mythology that they lose all self-consciousness, that they can or will still be able to laugh at themselves.
Mm.
They will.
Yeah.
Yeah, it appears that way. I'm thinking in terms also of this person out in the Midwest by the name of Tim Zell, who many years ago started the Church of All Worlds, which was somewhat based on religion, if you want to call it that, in a strange land.
Yeah, Heinlein would... Bob likes to keep at least 100 miles between himself and fans, and I'm sure that he would not enjoy that at all. And my own feeling about cultists is that I hope they're not too fanatical. I hope that they are capable of laughing at themselves and some of their antics.
Mm-hmm.
That they have elbow room inside the myth they are building.
Mm-hmm. Do you see positive aspects to cultism?
Oh, I think we ought to take a hand in myth construction. Myth construction happens to us so much that I think we ought to turn around and start engineering our myths and exploring the whole myth-making function of a society. And if we don't like certain myths, make others. We tend to fall into traps, into hero traps in our society. For God's sakes, look at what happened with the Kennedy clan. They fitted themselves right into a pre-organized, a pre-embedded myth, which was all the myth system, which was already in our society. Who called them Camelot? You see, who brought that out? It was a natural thing to happen. They had the young hero, the seeking the Holy Grail, who could do no evil. They had the Virgin Queen, who marries the young hero. They had the wise old man. They had the fool. I hope Pierre Salinger doesn't mind my calling him the fool. Well, in the tarot sense, you know, this is not a foolish thing.
Yeah.
The fool in tarot was the one who asked the improbable question.
Yes.
they had the magician, the man who does the impossible, who does the unexpected, Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
They had all of the characters that you find in classical mythology, and they had such perfect fits in their Camelot that you wondered if it just happened or if they did it.
I guess the last card in laying out this in that particular tarot plan would have been the Tower.
In fact, it is the world.
The world.
It is the world, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider, and I have a very strong suspicion that you do you consider science fiction, in fact, myth-making, myth-constructing?
A lot of science fiction is myth-making. I've written several books to explore different myth-making lines in our society. I wrote Destination Void, for example, to deal with that element of fandom, which believes that the only thing wrong with the universe is that we haven't invented the right machine yet. The machine becomes their god. It already is.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to examine these assumptions, these unexamined assumptions in our society. Take a good, long, cold look at them.
Mm-hmm.
We have right now upcoming a political campaign in which it is highly likely that Jimmy Carter will be elected president. Carter is setting himself up and being set up because it doesn't happen all from within. The society tends to reflect back on the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Is setting himself up to fit a certain mythological pattern, which is already there in the unconscious of our society. He has set a difficult role for himself, to be both the young hero and the wise old man simultaneously. I think he's capable of it. I just hope that he, personally, does not get lost in his own mythology, because we tend to kill our heroes in this society.
Mm-hmm.
In this Western society. And I think that that's a kind of an expelling a foreign body part of it in the society. That the society as a whole turns, gets violent.
Mm-hmm.
I deplore it. But I tell you, it does happen, and there's a long history of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are probably a limited number of myths that are simply destined to recycle themselves constantly?
Well, I think that that has been the history of myth-making in our society, because if you will find counterparts to Western mythology in Oriental mythology,
mm-hmm.
you find almost perfect fits. What I'm saying is that we ought to explore this myth-making facility in human beings as a consciousness exercise, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Would you correlate the Dune trilogy to any past myth?
Any past myth?
That is known, say, to classics majors or...
Well, I drew on Greek mythology mm-hmm. for it. Atreides, or the family of Atreus, you know, and a lot of people have spotted this. A lot of classical scholars have spotted it. And I deliberately did this.
I noted... in Children of Dune, that one of the people speaking to Alia from within is Agamemnon.
Yeah. No, and, the family of Atreus, you see.
The family goes back a very long way.
Yes.
It would bring about also an interesting question that since they span so many centuries from the Orestes' time through the time when Arrakis became a power, an economic power to deal with, where would the Atreus family be now?
You mean if they existed as a coherent unit?
Yes.
Where would they be?
Mm-hmm.
You mean in our society right now, today, or?
Well, in the 20th century, in the overall society, not 1970 necessarily, but
probably running oil tankers or banking in Switzerland.
Yeah, banking in Switzerland seems to fit.
Yeah. You see, how the power hierarchies are set up is, it happens the same way over and over and over and over again. I don't doubt at all, for example, that the Soviet Union, when it began, when the revolution started, that the people were idealists. For the most part. There were a few coldly cynical types there, I'm sure of that too. But I'm equally sure that most of the people who lent their muscle and their psyches to it were idealists who wanted to improve the lot of mankind. All right, look what's happened. They have created the most overweening, boulder-like, rock-like bureaucracy that the world has ever seen. And the creation of that kind of a bureaucracy, where it cannot be changed easily, is going to destroy them. Obviously, it's going to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been trying to copy their bureaucracy in our society. I think we have caught the ball ahead of it tumbling down and creating an avalanche. But I'm not absolutely sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet bureaucracy is a thing to marvel at, because bureaucracies in general tend to project people who are not imaginative, not creative, who are ultra-conservative, you see?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, people who, even if they have imaginative intellectual capabilities, suppress them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's survival. That is protective coloration in the area where they must live.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
If somebody came to you and said, well, Mr. Herbert, you are an extremely sophisticated science fiction writer with a great visionary future. We have this little planet called Mars. We don't know what to do with it, but we got some people there whose ideas have not yet been molded. And we want to just put a society on it that will be self-functioning. What society would you put there?
Well, number one, I'd worry about some of the absolutist assumptions in what society would you put there. I would hope that any society that we build after we find out how we build societies would not be so fixed to any one line that it couldn't change, because it's the ability to change and adapt that gives us our survival. And my dream is that we make the species immortal. Mm-hmm. That's why I like our going to Mars. Why not have that dream? Why not want to have grandchildren to the power of N, you see, infinite numbers of grandchildren off in that future who enjoy life and have all of the beauties of life that we have?
I don't know whether you've covered this, Jim, but it says on the back of the book that you have converted 6 acres or something into an ecological demonstration project. Did you talk about that
yet.
Already? I would really like to know about that.
Well, I'm in the process of working out means, not of isolated survival, but of joining with others.
Have you read Ecotopia, by any chance, by Ernst Kallenbach?
I know about the, yes, Ecotopia. I didn't understand you at first. I thought you said Utopia.
No, Ecotopia.
But Kallenbach got me. Yes, I've read it. I don't believe that any one answer is going to serve us. I'm very much against the use of fission power for electricity, but for none of the reasons that I hear being argued about. It's because I think that we're going to need all of our descendants, and they're going to need all of the real estate they can have, and there is no way that we have found yet to protect ourselves from the kamikaze. And I will give you one little example. Hanford on the Columbia River. A kamikaze attack on Hanford, on their storage right now, would make all of the downstream Columbia River real estate on both sides of the Columbia River uninhabitable. And we're just setting up a lot more of those little enclaves of potentially uninhabitable real estate. And the if you want to see how this is sinking into the psyche of various areas of the world, Great Britain, an island nation, and Japan, an island nation, have both drawn back very sharply from fission power. They know that if they go, if they don't go to a breeder reactor system, that they're going to run out of fuel by the year 2000, and the payoff doesn't seem good enough to them, and I agree with them. I've had some people from Hanford argue with me that, well, France isn't drawing back, but then my answer to that is, well, the people who brought us the Maginot Line and the Concorde can't be all wrong.
I gather you would look towards some kind of decentralized
Yes, I believe in... we have the capability right now of quadrupling at least our power, electrical power generation through the use of wind power. And I've demonstrated that to myself for perfect satisfaction. I have built a machine that will do it. Doesn't look like any windmill you ever saw, but it works magnificently. I don't believe that methane is an answer for rolling stock, that is, for running railroads and cars, but it's certainly a marvelous source of energy if you're going to run a stationary internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
So is alcohol. So is hydrogen. All of these things we can get from waste products. The whole concept in the American psyche of things you can throw away and forget about has to be stopped right now. There's no more a way where we can throw things, for one thing, and we need the energy that's potential in these things.
Because getting back to Dune and other books, I think one of the reasons, in my own view, that it was so popular with a lot of people who don't ordinarily enter the kind of science fiction reading situation was because of the ecological framework.
I'm sure that had something to do with it. I hope, though, that it's not taken up by people who are looking for someone who's guilty. We're going to make our own mistakes in our society. If I'd been born in my grandfather's time, I would have made my grandfather's mistakes. We have a terrible propensity in our society for finding guilty people and pointing fingers at them. And oftentimes these guilty people whom we accuse are in positions where they can make decisions of enormous consequences. And all we do by pointing fingers at them is alienate them.
I probably would have to agree with a small portion of that. However, I'm not so sure that power doesn't come into it at some level.
If you want to change the society and not just go on a big revolution trip, if you really want to change the society nonviolently, then we all have to participate in the change.
I agree with that, but I'm not so sure that's...
we have to set it up so that nobody is excluded from participation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to understand the reason some people can be excluded, and one of them is that we alienate them. Another one is that we have to understand the capitalization process on which our society operates. The capitalization process, which really is the best process we've ever found in the world for making more jobs. In other words, for making things where people will feel that they are justified in their own existence. We've come into some dead ends on it. I agree. We've made mistakes.
Yeah, that's my one fear about Carter, that he'll get us into another war. He'll make some new jobs and get us into another war.
What do you mean, military jobs?
All kinds of jobs, and that he'll find that that's...
Well, I don't think that that's his bag.
I don't either, but systems sometimes are more powerful.
Oh, I agree that systems can direct the decisions you make.
What technological things might possibly create this leverage in job situation as it currently stands?
Well, if we develop fusion power, for example.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was talking about fission, not fusion.
Right.
If we develop fusion power, and we're not at all sure yet that we have the plasma working techniques which will do this, but if we can do it, that's going to change the whole energy picture dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember that what we're dealing with now is a society where crunch decisions are made by people who control enormous blocks of energy,
mm-hmm.
and who believe that what is good for them will be good for the society. And that's not necessarily true.
The
oil cartel is not necessarily making decisions which will help the world at large.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the area, the interstellar area in which Dune takes place, you have an essentially capitalistic economic background. People are shipping spices, smuggling, very analogous to what we commercially have here. What would be a good working political frame to go with that capitalistic process?
Well, we have developed all kinds of political frameworks to use in our world. But the thing that you have to understand about the capitalistic process is that it adapts to change,
mm-hmm.
it makes jobs, and it is susceptible, if you don't overmanage it, it is susceptible to variations which are required by the society around it. Where we fall into traps is in overmanagement, over-legalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we do this out of urgent necessity, urgent immediate necessity. But then we never re-examine the conditions, we seldom re-examine the conditions, under which we made those management decisions, you see.
Do you think that we might be better off with an imperialistic capitalism?
An imperial capitalism?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, of course, what I was saying we had.
I'm sorry. What I'm...
you mean, do I think we as a society would be?
Yes.
Not necessarily, no. I'm just saying that that's one of the patterns we tend to fall into. We tend to fall into fiefdoms. After all, what's a corporation?
Mm-hmm.
What's a multinational corporation? There are 14... No, there are more than 20... multinational corporations in this world. And I'm not talking about American corporations. I'm talking about multinational corporations, which have budgets larger than France. Now, some of the smallest decisions that are made by executives in those corporations are going to have far-reaching consequences all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a certain point at which it's possible that the countries' borders may just break down, and that those multinational corporations will simply become the powers?
I have written such scenarios.
Can I ask which?
No stories. I've done it for corporate management executives.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. What is their basic reaction? Would it be, I assume...
Well, they're
be
shocked at first, and then they start exploring the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Where would those possibilities lead in terms of where people live? It would seem to me that you
would
have...
Well, if we get into too heavy a crisis situation in our world, where survival depends on corporate favor, corporate goodwill,
mm-hmm.
We could find people living in corporate enclaves, where the corporation protected them, fed them, gave them medical treatment, cradle to the grave by the corporation, you mm-hmm. see. But then you're just going to be building a new cyclic collision society where other corporations will fight. There will be battles between the corporations. I can see another scenario where corporations may prevent war because it's bad for business.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that people have not yet learned.
Yeah.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left to go. To continue with that, could people living under different corporations live together in the same geological area?
Why would they have to?
Well, they might.
Right now, you see, you'll find people who were born as American citizens, people who were born as citizens of France, people who were born as citizens of Great Britain, people who were born as citizens of Tunis, whose first loyalty is to a multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm.
We've found this in testimony in court cases in the United States by American citizens who admit openly that their first loyalty is to the corporation, not to the nation, but to the corporation.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of if you have, say, a non-sectionalized setup. In other words, you might have this...
What do you mean by sectionalized? You mean localized by area and language?
Yes. In other words, what you might end up having with is, would this be conceivable that in New York you're going to have people from 12 different corporations as such living together within the same city, but each pledging allegiance elsewhere? Might that
don't
not
we already
be,
have that?
Yes, but might that not be, in fact, a deterrent to this war on the grounds of, well, you can't just bomb the city. You're going to...
Well, of course, I suggested one time, quite seriously, that one way, if we really wanted to prevent war, one way to do it would be to negotiate massive exchanges of population for periods of up to 10 or 15 years. Between the Soviet Union and the United States, between the People's Republic of China and the United States, and the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union, where you just shift whole cities. And mm-hmm. you go to live in the Soviet Union, learn the language, learn the culture, live by their rules for, say, 10 years. You are, in effect, hostage to the good behavior of your people, of your American citizens. It would be, it's the way we used to do it. Kings used to have princes from neighboring nations living in their own household as hostages to the behavior of the nations on their borders.
Mm. That would really be a fascinating concept. Do you see that since you said these things do work cyclic, that could very well happen?
I could see this happening. I could see be a marvelous adventure for a whole city to say that they will trade with Murmansk and become, say, some city in the United States would become the city of Murmansk for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a massive dislocation and re-education process, you see. But I think it would have salutary effect on the world as a whole. I don't believe, however, in world government.
Mm-hmm.
I think that world government's a very bad show. I think our strength is in our differences. Not in the way we are identical. And world government would tend, under present conditions, I'm sure, to be disastrous. It's like the example I like to use is the example of driving an automobile, where there is a 5-minute delay between turning the steering wheel and the front wheels turning. How soon are you going to be in the ditch? The feedback between what is happening to the society and what we now call government is so slow that it's analogous to that picture of a steering wheel with a 5-minute delay.
Mm-hmm. Do you see people trying to steer us toward that world government now?
Oh, I see lots of movements toward world government around us, but I think that they are misguided idealists. Their intentions are right. But we know what the road to hell is paved with, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, I don't think that there are ever any too many political movements that have been paved with bad intentions.
No, I agree. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the saddest things about it, that it was to somebody, was always a good idea. There are no evil people.
I'm doing this to you for your own good. I'm sorry this rack is stretching your bones.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. But if I don't stretch your bones, you know...
You're going to hell.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The Spanish Inquisition all over. In the time remaining, what are there any things that you would simply like to take to task?
Oh, I think we've touched most of them already. I believe that the major argument I would make is against this kind of absolutist dominance of decision-making in our society. That this society, for example, created Richard Nixon. I am profoundly sympathetic to him because I'm quite sure that he never woke up any day in his life and said, "Today I'm going to do an evil thing."
Mm-hmm.
He was operating by the rules to which he was conditioned. The society created him. But then the society, needing a scapegoat, turned on him rather than looking to its own shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to do that time and again, not looking at the society's shortcomings, but picking ourselves a goat. We chase the goat out into the outer darkness and say, "Ah, that's cured it."
How does one change that society? How does one say, all of a sudden, through some miraculous vision in the sky that says, look inward, they look inward and see that it must, something has to be changed?
Well, we have to allow our politicians to make a few mistakes. They're mm-hmm. going to make them anyway, but under present conditions, if they make mistakes, they're going to cover them up.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't allow them to make mistakes. I think one of the most engaging things that Jimmy Carter, he endeared himself to me by saying, I blew it, when he was talking about ethnic communities. He said, I made a mistake. Well, that takes a lot of guts in this society if you want a political career, to stand up and say, I made a mistake. And maybe we're headed toward a new maturity in that we allowed it.
Mm. Okay, well, all I will say then is thank you very, very much, and it was a pleasure.
My pleasure. I hope to see you again.
Okay.
And as mentioned before, Frank Herbert, author of Dune, Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, and lots of other little Dune buggies and things like that. An amazing writer of many extremes, I think, is what Ken Gale had said when he first came in. And that is a very, very good description of Frank Herbert. But let me tell... So that interview was conducted when Children of Dune came out in 1976. Ian Forrest asked me, are you always so deferential? Am I more deferential now? And the answer is, Herbert was such a presence. He was such a strong and powerful presence that if he were in right now, yeah, I would be just as deferential. I don't think... You know, I might be more at ease, perhaps. But I'd probably be just as deferential. You know, Adler, you hear her. She's a real go-get-in-there kind of interview with all those chops. Even that's before NPR, but she had those chops always. And I provide a platform for people to talk. She does interviews. That's sort of like the difference between our styles. So let me also tell you that, it's 15 seconds to go. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start the outro on time, but not actually play it, so that it will end at 7 a.m., which means that I start it 3, 2, 1, now. But I still have to announce that this Tuesday, not the New York Review of Science Fiction, but rather Jim and John's excellent film series will begin in the same location at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is, he doesn't have all the information on one page, does he? At 138 Sullivan Street. That's between Prince and Houston. We are going to be showing a very bizarre, very wonderful movie called Kindzadza. Kindzadza. And just Google it up and find out more. It's a Russian comedy. It's Soviet Russian comedy from 1986. So it's Glasnost era science fiction a la Douglas Adams and Robert Sheckley. And if you think that the Russians could make a version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, yes, they did. And this is it. It's called Kindzadza. This Tuesday, June 8th at 6:30 p.m., so show up about 6 o'clock. It's a very, very short Russian movie, about 2 hours and 15 minutes, which is, for Russians, a short subject. And it's not free. Admission is not free. I do have to say that, but it's also not very expensive. It's cheaper than another movie. I do have to mention that. For more information, go to the Soho Gallery of Digital Art website, and you can get that address by going to Google. So thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. I'm not even sure of what it is. In 2 weeks, Elia Don Johnson will be my guest. So once again, thank you for listening. Thank you, Max, for setting up the machine. Thank you, Ken, for working this out, and enjoy yourself.
That was Hour of the Wolf, and if you missed any of it, you can go to WBAI.org in 10 or 15 minutes and listen to the whole show, his interview with Frank Herbert. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. Simon Locally will not be on with As I Please this week. Instead, we're bringing a rebroadcast of Behind the News with Doug Henwood from the 27th of May.
Hello and welcome to another special fundraising edition of Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and the focus tonight on politics, particularly of the Middle East, and of course the focus above all is on raising money for WBAI, which we will be turning our attention towards that all-important task in a few moments. The featured personality today is Norman Finkelstein, who is the author of This Time We Went Too Far. We'll be offering that book for a pledge of $80. Also, an interview I did with Norman the other day. We'll hear excerpts from that, but you can get the full 45-minute interview on a CD for a pledge of $30, or the two together, the book and the CD, for a pledge of $100. Norman Finkelstein is a historian by trade, but he now has dedicated most of his life to the pursuit of justice in the Middle East. He is the author of many books, including Image and Reality in the Israel-Palestine Conflict, The Holocaust Industry, and Beyond Chutzpah. But his most recent book is This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion, which is an analysis of what went on in Israel's invasion. As he points out in the interview, it's wrong to call it a war. It was just a one-sided massacre. He quotes an Israeli officer at the beginning of the book instructing his troops, "I'm not telling you to create a massacre, but ... which is a way of saying go out and create a massacre. And that is what Israel did on the Gaza Strip. The first part of Norman's book is a history of Gaza, and also a really detailed examination of what went on in that horrendous campaign and the political point of it, which was, as he will say, we'll hear from him shortly, saying that the intention was to restore Israel's deterrent power, which is the way military strategists say, restore Arabs' fear of Israeli military power and their willingness to use it with extreme prejudice. After Israel's defeat in Lebanon in 2006, the Israeli power was perhaps called somewhat into question in the minds of many of its Arab neighbors. And so Israel quite consciously decided to use Gaza as a proving ground for its capacity to create murder and mayhem, and it did that in great quantities. We do need you to pick up the phone and support WBAI, 212-209-2950, the number to call, 212-209-2950, the number to call. We've got one call on the line right now. I'm going to play some of Norman Finkelstein's interview, which you can get for a pledge of $30 in a few minutes. I will hold off on the begging until the first break. But just to put you in a phone calling and pledging mood, 212-209-2950, the number to call, for a pledge of $80. You can get This Time We Went Too Far, Norman Finkelstein's new book about Israel's invasion of Gaza at the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, just published by OR Books. A new publisher on the scene with a whole different model of publishing, but this isn't the time or place to talk about that. All right, let's listen to the beginning of my interview with Norman Finkelstein. There's a bit of noise at the beginning of it that and it gets taken away after about a minute or so. So here's Norman. Welcome, Norman. First, let's just start with a prehistory of the invasion. How did Gaza get to be one of the most godforsaken patches of earth on the planet?
Well, the main reason is what happened in 1948 when Israel expelled the indigenous population from what became Israel. A large number of the refugees ended up fleeing to Gaza. So by the end of the 1948 war, I think it was about 80% of Gaza's population consisted of refugees. And then on top of that, no doubt because the population is confined to the refugee camps, it's a very high population rate of population growth. So about half of the Gaza population is under 16 years old. And then beyond that, the occupation took a big toll in Gaza. The world's leading authority in Gaza's economy is the Harvard political economist, Sarah Roy. And she wrote a definitive study on Gaza. It was called The Redevelopment of Gaza. And Israel introduced policies, economic policies, which were basically designed to wreck the Gaza economy and make the population dependent on working in Israel.
So what then was the reason for the invasion end of 2008? Let's start with the political strategy that Israel had behind this invasion.
Well, in my opinion, the invasion didn't have much to do with Gaza. The invasion had much more to do with what happened in Lebanon in the summer of 2006. Israel suffered a major military defeat in Lebanon at the hands of the Party of God, the Hezbollah. And Israel was worried after the defeat it suffered that what it called its deterrence capacity had been significantly diminished. Deterrence capacity is just a fancy technical term for the Arab world's fear of Israel. And Israel was worried that the Arab world no longer feared it. The head of the Party of God, Sheikh Nasrallah, kept giving these speeches in which he taunted the Israelis and said, "The Arabs are no longer afraid of you. Go ahead and attack again. We'll defeat you again."
The balance of forces in Lebanon was very much in Israel's favor on paper, right? But they still lost.
Yeah, well, Israel had amassed a significant army and was prepared to deal a significant blow to the Party of God. But they suffered a huge defeat. They had assembled about 30,000 to 40,000 soldiers. The Hezbollah consisted of several thousand. And in fact, Israel didn't even face the crack Hezbollah troops who were stationed along the Litani waiting for the Israeli invasion. The Israeli army was basically defeated by villagers on the border, village militias on the border with Israel. And so now Israel needed a place to restore what it calls its deterrence capacity. It didn't yet have a military option against the Hezbollah. And so around 2008, it was focusing on an attack on Iran with the U.S.'s backing, of course. The U.S. vetoed it. So now the only place Israel could restore its deterrence capacity was in Gaza, because Gaza also presented itself with a certain amount of defiance and bravado like the Hezbollah, and it claimed the victory for Israel's redeployment in 2005. And so Israel felt here was the place it could restore the Arab world's fear of it. But it had one major problem. The problem is everybody knew that Hamas wasn't a fighting force, that it was not equipped to defeat an army. And so how do you restore your deterrence capacity? How do you get the Arab world to fear you when your foe is not a matching military force? And what Israel decided to do, and they were quite upfront about it, especially after the attack, what they decided to do was, and now I'm quoting Israeli officials, to act like a mad dog and to act lunatic, which is what they did in Gaza, to act like a mad dog, to act lunatic, or as the foreign minister Tzipi Livni said during the invasion, to go wild, in order to communicate to the Arab world that if you get out of hand, it's not going to be a conventional war. We're just going to go in and destroy everything in sight, which is what they did in Gaza.
What was the military strategy? How'd they go about doing that?
Well, there wasn't really a military strategy. I think the main misconception, the main misapprehension, and in effect the main propaganda device is to call what happened in Gaza a war. There was no war in Gaza. After the invasion was over, Israel was boasting and going around saying, now we have shown the Arabs who's who and what's what. We've cut the Arabs down to size. We've put the uppity Arabs in place, because they said, we won the war in Gaza. We won the war in Gaza. But then the Israeli military or strategic analyst, he said, it's very dangerous for Israel to go around saying it won the war when there was no war in Gaza. There was no, as he said, there wasn't a single battle fought in the 22 days of fighting in Gaza. One Israeli soldier described it as, he said, it was like PlayStation 2 computer game. Everything was done by remote control. And another Israeli soldier said, it was like a child with a magnifying glass burning ants. As a matter of fact, virtually every soldier who was interviewed conveyed the same experience. Never saw an Arab. Never contacted Hamas. Never had any tangle with the foe. There were no battles in Gaza. What happened in Gaza was, as one soldier after another said, especially if you look at the Israeli publication Breaking the Silence, which is composed of testimonies of Israeli soldiers, one soldier after another said, Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza.
Over the course of 3 weeks, I mean, what did they do over the course of relentlessly pummeling this rather small patch of ground over the course of 3 weeks? What did they accomplish in that 3 weeks?
Well, I'm not sure if accomplish is the right word. It's what did they destroy in those 22 days of what Amnesty International called the 22 days of death and destruction. The Goldstone report, it said that Israel launched a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population. That's word for word, verbatim, what it said. And that's, in effect, what it did. It targeted all of the civilian infrastructure in Gaza, destroyed the only operative flour mill, the Al-Badr flour mill, destroyed chicken farms, sent in tanks, and which just ran over the chickens, killed in one family. There were a family of four brothers, I think it was the Al-Siafari family, killed 100,000 chickens. It attacked